In June 2002, Renouard, sitting in the hot seat of operations director at Central Command, began to believe that the war plan he was working on for Iraq was going to be executed. But his discussions were extremely close-hold, he recalled, really involving just Rumsfeld and Franks, with Bush and Cheney briefed on occasion. Franks was told to keep a very tight control on decision-making, with it just a matter of Rumsfeld to Franks and a lot of decisions pushed up to Franks, that usually would have been handled by lower-ranking officials, but who in this case were not included in the planning. One unfortunate side effect of this narrowing seems to have been to limit consideration both of dissenting views and of longer-term issues, two problems that Franks already had experienced in his handling of the war in Afghanistan, which, insiders said, had been extremely messy. Those who could read the Bush administration best saw that war was coming, even before there had been much public debate. Two very different meetings bring this home, one among top British officials in London, the other among Marine commanders near San Diego. In midsummer, Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, the British intelligence agency, came to Washington for meetings at the CIA and with other officials. When he returned to London, he met with the top officials in the British National Security Establishment. There was a perceptible shift in attitude in the Bush administration, he told his colleagues on July 23rd, according to a memo summarizing the talk that subsequently was leaked. Military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. There was little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after military action. But much of the top brass wasn't persuaded of the wisdom of invading Iraq. Especially in the Army, there were profound doubts both about invading Iraq and about adopting a policy of preemption. Even one of the few military men Rumsfeld listened to, a retired four-star general, said at the time that containment was the way to go. He argued that what the U.S. government wanted was a secular, unified Iraq led by someone kinder and gentler than Saddam, and that was what it was getting closer to every day as Saddam aged and weakened. That summer, many generals had three major concerns about invading Iraq: the possibility of Saddam's using weapons of mass destruction, the danger of becoming enmeshed in urban warfare, and the worry that a post-war occupation could be costly, especially if the United States had to put in thousands of troops to hold the country together. "I can't tell you how many senior officers said to me, 'What in the hell are we doing?'" recalled Marine Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, who had been the J3, or Director of Operations, on the Joint Staff since October 2000. Yet for all those doubts, only one top officer really deeply objected to the entire war plan. That was Newbold, who, as the Joint Staff's Director of Operations, was aware of almost everything of significance going on in the U.S. military and to the classified information it was receiving. Many other senior officers weren't as opposed as Newbold, but still were worried about the particulars of the plan. Despite Franks's determined efforts to keep them from reviewing it, some began to get glimpses. One officer spent a summer weekend studying Annex Bravo, the intelligence section of the war plan. He came away deeply puzzled by a major discrepancy in its treatment of weapons of mass destruction. "The target list didn't match the text," he said. "The text was full of 'we're not sure,' 'we don't know this.' But then, when he turned to the target list, it offered, as if certain of its information, about 100 confirmed or positive weapons of mass destruction sites. Nor did the plan assess the impact on the region. It was completely stovepiped on Iraq. Nothing about terrorism or the impact on Saudi Arabia. This was just incomplete work, in his view." He sent his comments along, but never received a response. When Rumsfeld was asked about the worries being expressed inside the military, and specifically about a Washington Post article that summarized those concerns, using mainly unnamed sources, his response was both disingenuous and dismissive. "You know, the Pentagon's a big place. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of military personnel. Hundreds of thousands of civilian personnel," he said at a press conference at the headquarters of the Joint Forces Command in Suffolk, Virginia. Any reporter who wants to can go find one or more that'll have a position on any issue, all the way across the spectrum. Then what they do is, they write stories that seem to fit what they feel might make a good story, and they go around and ask questions until they find people that say those things, and then they print. Now, I don't know, he continued. They don't say who those people are, so I can't go and say, gee, have you got a better idea? Can't seem to do that. Who they are, no one knows. It's a big mystery, and life's like that. The officers who were talking to the Post and other news outlets, Rumsfeld concluded, were ill-informed. The defense secretary said he talked to senior military officers all the time and didn't hear such concerns. Thus, in Rumsfeld's formulation, military dissent about Iraq had to be considered the result of ignorance. To some at Central Command's headquarters in Tampa, the view was less mysterious. Hooker, the command's lead intelligence analyst for Iraq, later would blame Rumsfeld squarely for undermining the formulation of the war plan. From the outset, he said, the disagreements between Rumsfeld's office and the military about whether to invade Iraq, and if so, how many troops to use, were rooted in conflicting assessments of the threat Iraq presented and the difficulties that would result from invading and occupying the country. But instead of examining and reconciling the differences, Hooker wrote, Rumsfeld and Franks let them fester for months as Rumsfeld pushed for a smaller invasion force. There was no authoritative, systematic review and consolidation of viewpoints between intelligence producers and senior policymakers, Hooker concluded, in a post-war analysis of intelligence problems in the war plan. Rather than determine which point of view was correct, the planners simply split the difference, he wrote.